Thank you, Peg. And thank you, Nancy and Sarah, for the beautiful music, and Aaron. And thank you all for inviting me back for, wow, I think it's actually the fifth time. I just love being with you. In this last decade, I've been friends with four of your ministers and many of you. In that time, I've been blessed to witness you grow into this holy community and into this gorgeous space. How blessed can you be? So when Reverend Duffy called me a few weeks ago and invited me to speak, we had just observed Holocaust Memorial Day. And when I asked, what should I speak about? He said, well, why don't you speak about your reflections on the Holocaust this year? And so with your indulgence, I'll do that today. The million-dollar question, of course, is how could an enlightened Germany have coldly marched millions of human beings to their deaths in gas chambers, disposing of bodies in ovens and mass graves? How could ordinary Germans have so deeply demonized anyone who is different? Immigrants, homosexuals, gypsies, as to ultimately murder 16 million people, including 6 million Jews. And if we could even begin to grasp the magnitude of what happened, what must we learn from it? So those are the big questions that are on my mind this year, which I'll address in 17 minutes. So how the Holocaust happened isn't really that hard to say. Several ideologies converged to create fertile ground for Nazism to thrive. Extreme nationalism, racism, and the fusion of state and religion. These ideologies fed on one another to form a lethal combination. But abstract ideologies alone couldn't cause this. They needed a demagogue who could manipulate the fears and anxieties of Germans to drive those ideologies. So enter Hitler, who appealed to a German people that felt economically and culturally besieged following World War I. He manipulated their sense of themselves as victims, losing their culture, their Germanness, their race, their religion. And he pointed at the persecutors who were stealing their culture from them, Jews and other minorities. In his demagoguery, wealthy Jews were global elites controlling the economy. Global elites. And while poor Jews were leeches on German jobs and resources, many of whom were immigrants, and all Jews in their denial of Christ were a centuries-old threat to Christian religious dogma, Hitler promised to make Germany great again by ridding Germany of these threats to Aryan Christian German culture and prosperity. Now, Hitler did this through several sinister strategies designed to drive nationalism to a frenzy by demonizing minorities. Foremost among them was the relentless use of lies as political tools, waging war on the idea of objective truth itself to persuade Germans of their leaders' distorted version of reality. Joseph Goebbels, the minister of propaganda, would famously say, quote, "A lie told once remains a lie, but a lie told 1,000 times becomes the truth." He also said, "In the big lie, there is always a certain force of credibility." Hitler sold his lies by bypassing the press and reaching directly to people through the mass distribution of free radios, tuned only to the station broadcasting his rants. Another strategy involved systemic attacks on the press, called Lügenpresse, meaning the lying press, except for publications deemed friendly to the Nazis, of course. And a third strategy was to strategically rename opponents with slanderous slurs, regularly accusing the alleged persecutors and his political opponents of treason and encouraging violence against them. Still another contributing strategy involved the removal of checks that were built into the system. For example, the Enabling Act of 1933 gave Hitler power to declare emergencies and render the Reichstag, Germany's Congress, powerless. Eventually, the Reichstag was nullified entirely when it burned to the ground. And there was the Führerprinzip, the leader principle, which designated Hitler as above the law. The judiciary lost its independence. Judges had to be members of the National Socialist League for the maintenance of law, their version of the Federalist Society. The overarching legal principle became known as, quote, Nazi common sense, meaning whatever is good for Germany is legal. This allowed for the implementation of the Nuremberg Laws and other laws designed to protect German blood and honor from immigrants and undesirables. Gradually, all civil institutions were co-opted to serve the regime's single-minded fascist ideology. And we all know how it ended up. So let's fast forward to the Holocaust's aftermath. An international order wary of nationalism and racism promoted cooperation and human rights. The Geneva Convention outlawed war crimes for the first time ever, but like a deadly cancer in remission, nationalism and racism remained dormant, waiting to strike again. Today, that cancer is awakening, being revived by the same strategies. Americans, feeling besieged by economic and cultural changes, have rallied around Make Us Great Again nationalism, imbued with disdain for those others who are accused of taking jobs and white Christian European culture. Our leader effectively uses lies, attacks the press, bypasses Congress with so-called emergencies, stacks the courts with those who are sure to shore up his power, co-opts our institutions, all the while demonizing Muslims, brown people, and immigrants. Sound familiar? At a Holocaust Day event in Arkansas this year, protesters carrying Nazi flags and blow-up pictures of Jesus chanted, quote, 6 million more. A Tennessee judge posted on Facebook just last week that, quote, Jews should get the F over the Holocaust. Marchers in Charlottesville chanted, Jews will not replace us. We've seen synagogue shootings in California and Pittsburgh, and hundreds of anti-Semitic acts around the country. Now, thank God, we're nowhere near government-sponsored mass murder. However, we do tear immigrant children from their parents and put them in cages. We prosecute those who give water to immigrants fleeing death. We currently imprison 40,000 immigrants in grossly inhumane and unsafe conditions in what the LA Times and many others have called concentration camps. Our government argues that children held there are not entitled to beds or soap or toothbrushes. It's no wonder why so many of us suffer outrage fatigue. So most of you are no doubt well aware of the parallels between today's America and the lead up to the Holocaust. And so for the rest of my time today, I really want to focus on one critical factor which gets less attention. And that is the way that religion was and is being co-opted to serve the government's goals. In 1930s Germany, the three main Protestant churches, the Lutheran, Reformed, and United, joined together to form the German Christian movement. They combined Christianity and National Socialism to exclude all those that were deemed, quote, impure, and embrace all, quote, true Germans in a spiritual homeland for the Third Reich. They called themselves, quote, stormtroopers of Jesus Christ, and claimed a central place for Christianity in the Nazi regime. In a national vote by Protestants in 1933, they overwhelmingly elected Pastor Ludwig Müller to lead them. Hitler then appointed Müller as Reichsbishop, and just as the church became Nazi, Hitler latched onto the church, saying that with respect to Jews, the only difference between Martin Luther and him was that he, Hitler, had the courage to carry out his convictions. Even those Protestants who opposed the German Christian movement, called the Confessing Church, ultimately offered unconditional loyalty to Hitler, with just a few dissenters. Now, thankfully, today, most mainline Protestants have renounced their church's role in the Holocaust. But the phenomenon of the fusion of governments and their majority religions to empower an autocrat and persecute minorities is growing rapidly. In a recent Pew study of religious persecution by country, Christians were deemed the most persecuted faith community in the world, targeted in 144 countries. Muslims are a close second, targeted in 142 countries. We Jews lag behind in this six sweepstakes, persecuted in just 87 countries, but that's probably because there aren't enough of us to persecute. So while we focus on so much these days on sensational outbursts carried out in the name of religion at churches and synagogues and mosques, relatively little attention is paid to this pervasive worldwide religious harassment and persecution. The response of religious leaders to sensational outbursts is that these are a few extremists who don't really represent Islam or Judaism or Christianity, religions which all preach love. And for sure, they do not represent the ideals of our traditions. But a closer look suggests that religious extremism is far more mainstream than we want to admit, and is empowered by the growing fusions between religion and government. Examples abound. Iran, Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, Pakistan, and other Muslim countries, majority countries, regularly persecute minority Christians. In Israel, the marriage of nationalism, racism, and government-infused Judaism has resulted in the recent re-election of a far-right government, which has imprisoned 50,000 Palestinian children over the last years. In the Hindu-majority India, Prime Minister Modi just won re-election, appealing to Hindu nationalism, called Hindutva, an ideology which mainstreams anti-Muslim hatred. Last year, Buddhist-majority Myanmar saw mass killings of Muslims, and in China, there are now 1 million Muslims in internment camps. In Hungary, Poland, and other parts of Europe, a racist so-called Christian nationalism is on the rise, most prominently with the election of vile anti-Semite Viktor Orban in Hungary, who was just honored by our president with a White House visit. So that brings me to the United States, where our national identity is so deeply divided between that of a white European Christian country and a multicultural religious tolerant country. White supremacists are increasingly supporting our leaders and vice versa, with resulting increases in government-led Islamophobia and anti-Semitism and harsh policies directed at dark-skinned people, such as Puerto Ricans and immigrants seeking legal asylum. Like the Klan before them, many of today's white supremacists wear crosses, carry crosses, and have cross tattoos. Just as the cross has inspired millions of Christians to promote love and support victims of oppression, these Christians have twisted the cross into a swastika. The Christian right populist narrative in America is that white European Christian culture is under attack by laws which promote multiculturalism, allow equal opportunity for those of different races, religions, and genders, laws which allow women to control their bodies or homosexuals to marry. So they must fight back to preserve their culture. The president's spiritual advisor, Paula White, just a couple of weeks ago claimed that the president was, quote, anointed by God as America's defender. She opened his re-election announcement with a prayer to, quote, stop the demonic networks aligned against him. Leading evangelist Jim Baker, says we're close to the Bible being illegal in America, so we must pray for Trump. While Franklin Graham led a national day of prayer a couple of weeks ago for the president, who he said is under attack, quote. The American Family Association, a group funded by Montana's own congressman, describe this day of prayer as a type of spiritual warfare necessary because the president's many accomplishments make him very unpopular with the devil and the kingdom of darkness. Some in this group seek a Christian theocracy, our version of Saudi Arabia or Iran. Typical is popular Christian TV host Rick Wiles, who has millions of followers and says, quote, why are you imposing Judaism on me? Because that's exactly what's been done in America since 1973 with Roe v. Wade. Judaism was imposed on me, on my Christian nation, and we became a Jewish nation that kills babies. That's against my Christian beliefs. Judaism became the law of the land in America. That's precisely what the courts have ruled, resulting in the death of millions of babies, We Christians are standing up and we're telling you that we're done with your values. We are going to impose Christian values in America again, whether you like it or not. Christians are going to take back America from the Jews and impose Christian values and Christian rule." End quote. Incidentally, the alleged Jewish killing of babies was one of the most prominent anti-Semitic themes in medieval Europe, leading up to the Holocaust. In fact, that's a theme that runs through all discrimination of the persecution throughout the world. Gypsies were accused of stealing babies and other groups as well. So today's worldwide populism is joined at the hip with the sort of right-wing religious backlash, both claiming that secular elites are stealing the culture of white Christian European Americans, stealing their nation, their prosperity, their religion. Whether it's the Eurasian traditionalism of Putin, the Christian democracy of Hungary's Orban, the jihad of the Ayatollahs, the prosperity Pentecostalism of Brazil's Bolsonaro, the populist Catholicism of Italy's Salvini, the Hindu nationalism of India's Modi, the fundamentalist Judaism of Netanyahu, and the fundamentalist Christianity of Trump and Pence, all represent a religiously infused reaction to secular governance and the secular elites who propagate it. The use of religion has nothing to do with the doctrinal strength of religious life. Rather, just as Hitler used it, today's populists' use of religion offer a way of forging a new consensus. It's a tool to engage a society that many believe has lost its moral center. The effect has been to empower the most outrageous and extreme religious fundamentalists, relegating religious progressives to the sidelines. This has allowed fundamentalists to take over the mantle of religion in the public's mind. We religious progressives have not forcefully fought back by calling out fundamentalism within our own traditions, owing to a wrong-headed idea that we shouldn't be, quote, political or divisive. I'm overjoyed to hear Mayor Pete say that we must bring the voice of progressive religion back into the public conversation. Our religious leaders need to remind us that the third of the biblical commandments, which tells us to never make wrongful use of the divine name, that the deeper meaning of that commandment is to never use the name of God to justify our personal hatreds. Ironically, in cooperation with some governments, that's exactly what's happening. In fact, two distinct notions of God have developed across every religious tradition. One God is who we talk about when we sit around the campfire late at night and wonder how we got here and what life is about. The second is what we talk about when we stand around a burning pyre, hurling stones and abuses at the heretics being grilled there. The latter is the God of the crusaders and the jihadists, of the inquisitors, the misogynists, the homophobes. At the same time that religious leaders call us back to the third commandment, and the prohibition of the use of God's name to justify personal hatreds, we need to be asking, what is it deep within our respective traditions that allows our holy teachings to be twisted from a cross or a star into a swastika? So I want to close with a small detour and a final lesson from the Holocaust. And I apologize in advance to those who read my column in the paper this morning. A teaching that might help us move forward. I was recently doing our interfaith radio show on AM talk radio when the subject of anger and fear turned to road rage in Bozeman. Callers jammed the lines to claim that road rage is pervasive here. Now, I'm a cyclist and I occasionally experience an angry driver, but an overwhelming number of drivers are courteous, often giving me a wide berth when we share a road. When I pull off the side of the road to get some drinks of water or adjust my bike, oftentimes they'll stop and say, "Are you okay?" So why are so many people attached to the road rage narrative when it is a very rare phenomenon in comparison to courteous and helpful drivers? Why don't we ever hear that Bozeman drivers are overwhelmingly very courteous? Well, pervasive road rage is a powerful narrative because it can affirm an underlying worldview that I'm good, but others are bad and out to get me. Road rage is serious, but we easily confuse the severity of a bad event with its frequency. The Holocaust happened because a demagogue cleverly perpetuated the lie that the other was persecuting good, well-meaning white Christian Germans. And that's the bottom line. Perhaps our strongest response to the Holocaust today can be to not feed that monster. We do that by continually reinforcing for ourselves and our children what 13-year-old Anne Frank wrote in her diary while holed up in an Amsterdam attic in a time much darker than ours. Quote, "In spite of everything, I still believe that people are really good at heart. I simply can't build up my hopes on a foundation consisting of confusion, misery, and death. I see the world gradually being turned into a wilderness. I hear the ever-approaching thunder, which will destroy us too. I can feel the suffering of millions, and yet, if I look up to the heavens, I think that it will all come out right, that this cruelty too will end, and that peace and tranquility will return again." End quote. These words of Anne Frank inspire me every day. We must never give up on a worldview where people are basically good at heart, no matter how much outrage fatigue we may get. That worldview is the vaccine that prevents demagogues from making malignant the cancer of hate. During the Holocaust, a great rabbi taught that the Nazi desire to exterminate Jews was at its roots a desire to eliminate the connection to the Holy One. And this insight rests heavy on my heart right now. No matter our faith path, if we live with an awareness that we all emerge from a single sacred source, we find ourselves in opposition to the forces that deny the inherent value of all life, and faith itself becomes a form of resistance. May all of our faiths become a form of resistance. Shalom and peace.